markers. There were squares in every direction. I counted 8 of them. 10. 14. Or was it 12? There are exactly 21 squares, an elderly lady told me later in the afternoon. Her name was Mary Hardy. Acquaintances in Charleston had put us in touch. She had been expecting me. She had white hair and arched eyebrows that gave her a look of permanent surprise. We stood in her kitchen while she mixed martinis in a silver shaker. When she was finished, she put the shaker into a wicker basket. She was going to take me on an excursion, she said. It was too nice a day, and I had too little time in Savannah for us to waste it indoors. As far as Miss Hardy was concerned, the squares were the jewels of Savannah. No other city in the world had anything like them. There were 5 on Bull Street, 5 on Barnard, 4 on Abercorn, and so on. James Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia, had been responsible for them, she said. He had decided Savannah was going to be laid out with squares based on the design of a Roman military encampment even before he set sail from England, before he even knew exactly where on the map he was going to put Savannah. When he arrived in February 1733, he chose a site for the city on top of a 40-foot bluff on the southern bank of the Savannah River, 18 miles inland from the Atlantic. He had already sketched out the plans. The streets were to be laid out in a grid pattern, crossing at right angles, and there would be squares at regular intervals. In effect, the city would become a giant parterre garden. Oglethorpe built the first 4 squares himself. "The thing I like best about the squares," Miss Hardy said, "is that cars can't cut through the middle. They must go around them. So traffic is obliged to flow at a very leisurely pace. The squares are our little oases of tranquility." As she spoke, I recognized in her voice the coastal accent described in Gone with the Wind. Soft and slurring, liquid of vowels, kind to consonants. "But actually," she said, "the whole of Savannah is an oasis. We are isolated, gloriously isolated. We're a little enclave on the coast, off by ourselves, surrounded by nothing but marshes and piney woods. We're not easy to get to at all, as you may have noticed. If you fly here, you usually have to change planes at least once, and trains are not much better. Somebody wrote a novel in the 1950s that captured it rather well, I thought. The View from Pompey's Head. It's by Hamilton Basso. Have you read it? The story opens with a young man taking the train from New York to Pompey's Head and having to get off at the ungodly hour of 5 in the morning. Pompey's Head is supposed to be Savannah, and I have no quibble with that. We're a terribly inconvenient destination." Miss Hardy's laughter was as light as wind chimes. "There used to be a train that ran between here and Atlanta, the Nancy Hanks. It shut down altogether 20 years ago, and we don't miss it at all." "Don't you feel cut off?" I asked.
"Cut off from what?" she replied.
"No, on the whole I'd say we rather enjoy our separateness. Whether that's good or bad, I haven't any idea. Manufacturers tell us they like to test market their products in Savannah, toothpaste and detergents and the like, because Savannah is utterly impervious to outside influence. Not that people haven't tried to influence us. Good Lord, they try all the time. People come here from all over the country and fall in love with Savannah. Then they move here, and pretty soon they're telling us how much more lively and prosperous Savannah could be if we only knew what we had and how to take advantage of it. I call these people Gucci carpetbaggers. They can be rather insistent, you know, even rude. We smile pleasantly and we nod, but we don't budge an inch. Cities all around us are booming urban centers, Charleston, Atlanta, Jacksonville, but not Savannah. The Prudential Insurance people wanted to locate their regional headquarters here in the 1950s. It would have created thousands of jobs and made Savannah an important center of a nice, profitable, non-polluting industry.
But we said no. Too big. They gave it to Jacksonville instead. In the 1970s, Giancarlo Menotti considered making Savannah the permanent home for his Spoleto USA festival. Again, we were not interested. So Charleston got it. It's not that we're trying to be difficult. We just happen to like things exactly the way they are.
Miss Hardy opened a cupboard and took out two silver goblets. She wrapped each of them in a linen napkin and placed them carefully in the wicker basket beside the martinis.
"We may be standoffish," she said, "but we're not hostile. We're famously hospitable, in fact, even by Southern standards. Savannah's called the hostess city of the South, you know. That's because we've always been a party town. We love company. We always have. I suppose that comes from being a port city and having played host to people from faraway places for so long. Life in Savannah was always easier than it was out on the plantations. Savannah was a city of rich cotton traders who lived in elegant houses within strolling distance of one another. Parties became a way of life, and it's made a difference. We're not at all like the rest of Georgia. We have a saying. If you go to Atlanta, the first question people ask you is, what's your business? In Macon, they ask, where do you go to church? In Augusta, they ask your grandmother's maiden name. But in Savannah, the first question people ask you is, what would you like to drink?
She patted the basket of martinis. I could hear the echo of Captain Flint shouting for rum. Savannah's always been wet, she said, even when the rest of Georgia was dry. During Prohibition, filling stations on Abercorn Street sold whiskey out of gas pumps. Oh, you could always get a drink in Savannah. That's never been any secret. I remember when I was a child, Billy Sunday brought his Holy Revival Crusade to town. He set himself up in Forsyth Park and everybody went to hear him. There was great excitement. Mr. Sunday got up and declared at the top of his voice that Savannah was the wickedest city in the world. Well, of course, we all thought that was perfectly marvelous. Miss Hardy handed me the basket and led the way through the hall and out the front door to my car. With the basket on the seat between us, she guided me as I drove through the streets.
"I'm going to take you to visit the dead," she said.
We had just turned onto Victory Drive, a long parkway completely covered by an arch of live oaks dripping with Spanish moss. In the center, a double colonnade of palms marched along the median strip as if lending architectural support to the canopy of oaks and moss. I glanced at her, not sure I'd heard correctly.
"The dead?"
"The dead are very much with us in Savannah," she said.
"Everywhere you look, there's a reminder of things that were, people who lived. We're keenly aware of our past. Those palms, for example, they were planted in honor of soldiers from Georgia who died in the First World War."
After driving 3 or 4 miles, we turned off Victory Drive onto a winding road that took us to the gates of Bonaventure Cemetery. A live oak forest of a primeval dimension loomed before us. We parked the car just inside the gate and continued on foot, coming almost at once to a large white marble mausoleum.
"Now, if you should die during your stay in Savannah," Miss Hardy said with a gentle smile, "this is where we'll put you. It's our stranger's tomb. It was built in honor of a man named William Gaston. He was one of Savannah's greatest hosts and party givers, and he died in the 19th century. This tomb is a memorial to his hospitality. It has an empty vault in it that's reserved for out-of-towners who die while visiting Savannah. It gives them a chance to rest a while in one of the most beautiful cemeteries in the world, until their families can make arrangements to take them away." I remarked that I hoped I wouldn't tax Savannah's hospitality to that extent. We moved on past the tomb, along an avenue bordered by magnificent oaks. On both sides, moss-covered statues stood in an overgrowth of shrubbery, like the remnants of an abandoned temple. In colonial times, this was a lovely plantation, Miss Hardy said. Its centerpiece was a mansion made of bricks brought over from England. There were terraced gardens extending all the way down to the river. The estate was built by Colonel John Mulrin. When Mulrin's daughter married Josiah Tatnall, the bride's father commemorated the happy union of the two families by planting great avenues of trees, forming the initials M and T intertwined. I'm told enough of the original trees survive that you can still trace the monogram, if you put your mind to it. Miss Hardy paused as we approached a vine-covered mound by the side of the path. This is all that's left of the plantation house, she said. It's a piece of the foundation. The house burned sometime in the late 1700s. It was a spectacular fire, by all accounts. A formal dinner party had been in progress, with liveried servants standing behind every chair. In the middle of dinner, the butler came up to the host and whispered that the roof had caught fire and that nothing could be done to stop it. The host rose calmly, clinked his glass, and invited his guests to pick up their dinner plates and follow him into the garden. The servants carried the table and chairs after them, and the dinner continued by the light of the raging fire. The host made the best of it. He regaled his guests with amusing stories and jests while the flames consumed his house. Then, in turn, each guest rose and offered a toast to the host, the house, and the delicious repast. When the toasts were finished, the host threw his crystal glass against the trunk of an old oak tree, and each of the guests followed suit. Tradition has it that if you listen closely on quiet nights, you can still hear the laughter and the shattering of crystal glasses. I like to think of this place as the scene of the eternal party. What better place in Savannah to rest in peace for all time, where the party goes on and on? We resumed our walk, and in a few moments came to a small family plot shaded by a large oak tree. Five graves and two small date palms lay inside a low curbstone. One of the graves, a full-length white marble slab, was littered with dried leaves and sand. Miss Hardy brushed the debris away, and an inscription emerged. John Herndon Mercer. Johnny. Did you know him? I asked. We all knew him, she said, and loved him. We always thought we recognized something of Johnny in each of his songs. They had a buoyancy and a freshness, and that's the way he was. It was as if he'd never really left Savannah. She brushed away more of the leaves and uncovered an epitaph. And the angels sing. For me, she said, Johnny was literally the boy next door. I lived at 222 East Gwinnett Street. He lived at 226. Johnny's great-grandfather built a huge house on Monterey Square, but Johnny never lived in it. The man who lives there now has restored it superbly and made it into quite a showplace. Jim Williams. My society friends are wild about him. I'm not. Miss Hardy squared her shoulders and said no more about the Mercers or Jim Williams. We continued along the path toward the river, which was just now visible up ahead under the trees. And now, I have one more thing to show you, she said. We walked to the crest of a low bluff overlooking a broad, slow-moving expanse of water, clearly the choicest spot in this most tranquil of settings. Miss Hardy led me into a small enclosure that had a gravestone and a granite bench. She sat down on the bench and gestured for me to sit next to her. At last, she said, we can have our martinis. She opened the wicker basket and poured the drinks into the silver goblets. If you look at the gravestone, she said, you'll see it's a bit unusual. It was a double gravestone, bearing the names of Dr. William F. Aiken and his wife, Anna. They were the parents of Conrad Aiken, the poet. Notice the dates.
Both Dr. and Mrs. Aiken had died on the same day, February 27th, 1901.
"This is what happened," she said.
The Aikens were living on Oglethorpe Avenue, in a big brick townhouse. Dr. Aiken had his offices on the ground floor, and the family lived on the two floors above. Conrad was 11. One morning, Conrad awoke to the sounds of his parents quarreling in their bedroom down the hall. The quarreling subsided for a moment. Then Conrad heard his father counting. 1, 2, 3. There was a half-stifled scream, and then a pistol shot. Then another count of 3, another shot, and then a thud. Conrad ran barefoot across Oglethorpe Avenue to the police station, where he announced, "Papa has just shot Mama, and then shot himself." He led the officers to the house and up to his parents' bedroom on the top floor.
Miss Hardy lifted her goblet in a silent toast to Dr. and Mrs. Aiken. Then she poured a few drops onto the ground.
"Believe it or not," she said, "one of the reasons he killed her was parties." Aiken hinted at it in Strange Moonlight, one of his short stories. In the story, the father complains to the mother that she's neglecting her family. He says, "It's 2 parties every week, and sometimes 3 or 4. That's excessive." The story was autobiographical, of course. The Aikens were living well beyond their means at the time. Anna Aiken went out to parties practically every other night. She'd given 6 dinner parties in the month before her husband killed her. After the shooting, relatives up north took Conrad in and raised him. He went to Harvard and had a brilliant career. He won the Pulitzer Prize and was appointed to the poetry chair at the Library of Congress. When he retired, he came back to spend his last years in Savannah. He always knew he would. He'd written a novel called Great Circle. It was about ending up where one started. And that's the way it turned out for Aiken himself. He lived in Savannah his first 11 years and his last 11 years. In those last years, he lived next door to the house where he'd lived as a child, separated from his tragic childhood by a single brick wall. Of course, when he moved back to Savannah, the Poetry Society was all a flutter, as you can imagine, but Aiken kept pretty much to himself. He politely declined most invitations. He said he needed the time for his work. Quite often, though, he and his wife would come out here and sit for an hour or so. They'd bring a shaker of martinis and silver goblets and talk to his departed parents and pour libations to them.
Miss Hardy raised her goblet and touched it to mine. A pair of mockingbirds conversed somewhere in the trees. A shrimp boat passed at slow speed.
"Aiken loved to come here and watch the ships go by," she said. "One afternoon, he saw one with the name Cosmos Mariner painted on the bow. That delighted him. The word cosmos appears often in his poetry, you know. That evening, he went home and looked for mention of the Cosmos Mariner in the shipping news. There it was, in tiny type on the list of ships in port. The name was followed by the comment, 'Destination unknown.' That pleased him even more."
"Where is Aiken buried?" I asked. There were no other gravestones in the enclosure.
"Oh, he's here," she said. "In fact, we are very much his personal guests at the moment. It was Aiken's wish that people should come to this beautiful place after he died and drink martinis and watch the ships, just as he did. He left a gracious invitation to that effect. He had his gravestone built into the shape of a bench."
An involuntary reflex propelled me to my feet. Miss Hardy laughed, and then she too stood up. Aiken's name was inscribed on the bench, along with the words,
Cosmos Mariner. Destination unknown. I was beguiled by Savannah. The next morning, as I checked out of the hotel, I asked the desk clerk how I might go about renting an apartment for a month or so. Not right then, but soon, perhaps. "Dial bedroom," she said. "On the telephone. BEDROOM. It's the number of a referral service for guest houses. They have listings." I suspected that in Savannah I had stumbled on a rare vestige of the old South. It seemed to me that Savannah was in some respects as remote as Pitcairn Island, that tiny rock in the middle of the Pacific where the descendants of the mutineers of the HMS Bounty had lived in inbred isolation since the 18th century. For about the same length of time, seven generations of Savannians had been marooned in their hushed and secluded bower of a city on the Georgia coast. "We're a very cousin-y people," Mary Hardy told me. "One must tread very lightly here. Everyone is kin to everyone else." An idea was beginning to take shape in my mind, a variation of my city-hopping weekends. I would make Savannah my second home. I would spend perhaps a month at a time in Savannah, long enough to become more than a tourist, if not quite a full-fledged resident. I would inquire, observe, and poke around wherever my curiosity led me, or wherever I was invited. I would presume nothing. I would take notes. Over a period of 8 years, I did just that, except that my stays in Savannah became longer, and my return trips to New York shorter. At times, I came to think of myself as living in Savannah. I found myself involved in an adventure peopled by an unusual assortment of characters and enlivened by a series of strange events, up to and including murder. But first things first. I went to the telephone and dialed bedroom. Chapter 3. The Sentimental Gentleman. The voice that spoke to me from bedroom led me to my new home in Savannah, the second floor of a carriage house on East Charlton Lane. I had two small rooms that looked out on a garden and the rear of a townhouse. The garden had a fragrant magnolia and a small banana tree. The apartment's furnishings included an old navigator's globe on a stand. On my first night in residence, I put my finger on Savannah and, turning the globe, followed the 32nd parallel around the world. Marrakesh, Tel Aviv, and Nanking passed beneath my finger. Savannah stood on the westernmost point of the East Coast, due south of Cleveland. It was south of New York by 9 degrees of latitude, which should have been enough to make a difference in the angle of the moon in the sky, I figured. The crescent would be turned clockwise slightly tonight, so that it would look more like the letter U than the letter C it had been the night before in New York. Or would it be the other way around? I looked out the window to see, but the moon had slipped behind a cloud. It was at about that time, as I was attempting to fix my exact location in the universe, that I became aware of laughing voices and the sound of a honky-tonk piano coming over the garden wall. The song was Sweet Georgia Brown, and it was sung by a smooth baritone voice. The next song was How Come You Do Me Like You Do. A party was in progress a few houses away, and I took this to be a good sign. The music made an agreeable background sound, if a little corny, and the piano player was very good. Tireless, too. The last song I remember that night before falling asleep was Lazy Bones. It was written, appropriately enough, by Johnny Mercer. A few hours later, shortly after dawn, the music started in again. Piano Roll Blues was the first tune of the morning, as I recall. Then came Darktown Strutter's Ball. The music continued in that vein, off and on, throughout the day and late into the evening. It did the same the following day, and the day after that. The piano was a permanent part of the atmosphere, apparently, and so was the party, if a party was what it was. I traced the music to 16 East Jones Street,
a yellow stuccoed townhouse 4 houses away. In most respects, the house was like all the others on the block, except for a steady stream of visitors who came and went at all hours of the day and night. There was no common denominator among them. They were young and old, alone and in groups, white and black, but I did notice that none of them rang the bell or knocked. They just pushed the door open and walked in. Unlocked doors were highly unusual, even in Savannah. I assumed that eventually all of this would explain itself, and in the meantime, I set about becoming acquainted with my new surroundings. The garden part of the city, with its geometrical arrangement of squares, encompassed the 3-square-mile historic district, which was built before the Civil War. City fathers abandoned the squares later on when the city expanded southward. Immediately south of the historic district lay a wide swath of Victorian gingerbread houses. These gave way to Ardsley Park, an enclave of early 20th century houses with proud facades that featured columns, pediments, porticos, and terraces. South of Ardsley Park, the scale of the houses diminished. There were bungalows built in the 30s and 40s, then ranch houses of the 50s and 60s, and finally the south side, a flat, semi-rural terrain that could have been anywhere in America, except for the occasional echoes of Dixie, such as the 12 Oaks Shopping Plaza and the Tara Cinemas. At the Georgia Historical Society, an obliging librarian clarified a few matters for me. No, she said, there had never been any such woman as hard-hearted Hannah. The librarian suspected that Hannah had simply been the product of a songwriter needing a rhyme. She added with a sigh that sometimes she wished Hannah had been the vamp of Montana instead. Savannah could lay claim to enough real history, she said, that it had no need of false honors. Did I know, for instance, that Eli Whitney had invented the cotton gin at Mulberry Plantation in Savannah? Or that Juliet Gordon Lowe had founded the Girl Scouts of America in a carriage house on Drayton Street? The librarian recited a list of Savannah's historic highlights. America's first Sunday school had been founded in Savannah in 1736, America's first orphanage in 1740, America's first Black Baptist congregation in 1788, America's first golf course in 1796. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, had been the minister of Christ Church in Savannah in 1736, and during his tenure had written a book of hymns that became the first hymnal used in the Church of England. A Savannah merchant had bankrolled the first steamship ever to cross the Atlantic, the Savannah, which made its maiden ocean voyage from Savannah to Liverpool in 1819. The cumulative weight of all these historic firsts suggested that this sleepy city of 150,000 had once been more important in the general scheme of things than it was now. Sponsoring the world's first ocean-going steamship in 1819, for instance, would have been the equivalent of launching the first space shuttle today. President James Monroe had made a special trip to Savannah in honor of the maiden voyage, a fair indication of its importance. I browsed among the books, prints, and maps in the Society's reading room, a spacious hall with a high ceiling and a double tier of bookshelves along the walls. The Civil War loomed large in this room, and Savannah's role in it was a story that seemed to say a great deal about the city. At the outbreak of fighting, Savannah was the world's leading cotton port. General William Tecumseh Sherman selected it as the climax for his triumphant march to the sea, bringing 70,000 troops against Savannah's 10,000. Unlike their counterparts in Atlanta and Charleston, Savannah's civic leaders were practical businessmen, and their secessionist passions were tempered by a sobering awareness of the devastation that was about to befall them. When Sherman drew near, the mayor of Savannah led a delegation out to meet him. They offered to surrender the city without a shot if Sherman promised not to burn it. Sherman accepted the offer and sent President Lincoln a famous telegram. I beg to present to you, as a Christmas gift, the city of Savannah, with 150 guns and plenty of ammunition, also about 25,000 bales of cotton. Sherman stayed a month, and then marched to Columbia, South Carolina, and burned it to the ground. Savannah emerged from the war impoverished, but it recovered within a few years and prospered once again. By then, however, the city's financial underpinnings had begun to erode. Rural labor was being drawn away to the industrialized north. Years of growing nothing but cotton had leached the soil of nutrients, and the center of the cotton belt had moved westward. In the financial panic of 1892, the price of a pound of cotton dropped from a dollar to 9 cents. By 1920, the boll weevil had wiped out what little cotton activity was left. From that time onward, Savannah slipped into decline. Many of its once great houses fell into disrepair. Lady Astor, passing through in 1946, remarked that Savannah was like a beautiful woman with a dirty face. Stung by the criticism, a group of concerned citizens began in the 1950s to restore Savannah's downtown. Their effort resulted in the preservation of Savannah's historic district. Before leaving the reading room, I thought to look in the 1914 city directory for the name of Sadie Jefferson, the woman who had tangoed all the way to the police station. She wasn't listed. No Jeffersons were listed at all, in fact. The librarian looked at my old newspaper clipping and told me I had probably consulted the wrong part of the city directory. "You can tell from the wording of the news item that Sadie Jefferson was black," she said, "because the courtesy title of Mrs. or Miss is omitted." That was the practice until integration. It was also the practice to list blacks in a separate section of the city directory. That's probably why you didn't find her. Indeed, Sadie Jefferson was listed in the colored section of the 1914 city directory, the wife of James E. Jefferson, a barber. She died in the 1970s. The story of blacks in Savannah was, of course, a very different one from that of whites. Slavery was forbidden in Georgia in 1735. Oglethorpe called it a horrid crime. But in 1749, the colony's trustees gave in to pressure from the settlers and legalized it. Despite a long history of oppression, the 1960s civil rights movement in Savannah was almost entirely nonviolent. Civil rights leaders staged sit-ins at lunch counters, swim-ins at the beach, kneel-ins in churches, and a 15-month boycott of segregated stores. Tensions rose, but peace prevailed, largely because of the tireless efforts of a forward-thinking mayor, Malcolm McLean, and a nonviolent strategy adopted by black leaders, notably W.W. Law, the head of the local branch of the NAACP. In 1964, Martin Luther King declared Savannah the most desegregated city in the South. In 1980, the population of Savannah was half white and half black. There was ample evidence in the records of the Historical Society that in Savannah's palmier days, it had been a cosmopolitan city and its citizens an unusually worldly sort. Mayor Richard Arnold, the man who had sweet-talked General Sherman in and out of town during the Civil War, was typical of the breed. He was a physician, a scholar, an epicure, a connoisseur of fine wines, and a gentleman who took his social obligations seriously. He wrote in one letter, "Yesterday I entertained the Honorable Howell Cobb at a sociable dinner party. We sat down at 3 o'clock and got up at 9:30. Mayor Arnold's 6.5-hour dinner lent weight to what I had been told about Savannah's fondness for parties, and it put me in mind of the genteel merriment going on non-stop in the townhouse down the street from me at 16 East Jones Street. My casual surveillance of the house paid off one day at noontime. A car drew up to the curb and screeched to a jolting stop. At the wheel was a neatly dressed elderly lady with white hair as neat as pie crust. She had made no attempt to parallel park, but had instead pulled into the space front end first, as if tethering a horse to a hitching post. She got out and marched to the front door, took a ball-peen hammer out of her purse, and methodically smashed all the little panes of glass around the door. Then she put the hammer back in her purse and walked back to her car. The incident didn't seem to make any difference to the people in the house. The piano went right on playing, and the voices kept on laughing. The panes of glass were replaced, but not until several days later. As I expected, it all became perfectly clear soon enough. One night after dinner, I heard the click of spike heels coming up the steps, followed by a gentle knock on the door. I opened it to behold a beautiful woman standing in the moonlight. Her head was tucked into a platinum cloud of cotton candy hair. She wore a low-cut pink dress, which she filled voluptuously, and she was giggling.
"Wouldn't you know," she said, "they've gone and turned off Joe's electricity again."
"They have," I answered. "Who is Joe?" She was momentarily confused.
"You don't know Joe? I thought everybody knew Joe. He's your neighbor. I mean, he's almost your neighbor. Joe Odom."
She waved in a westerly direction.
"He lives a couple of houses down that way."
"Not the house with the piano." This comment sent the woman into gales of pretty laughter.
"Uh-huh, you got it."
"And is Joe Odom the one who plays the piano?"
"He sure is," she said. "And I'm Mandy. Mandy Nichols. I don't mean to disturb you or anything, but I saw your light on. Anyway, we've run out of ice, and I was sort of hoping you could spare some."
I invited her in. As she brushed by me, I breathed the essence of gardenia. I recognized her now as one of the many people I had seen going into the house down the street. There was no way I could possibly have forgotten her. She was a statuesque beauty with not a single angular contour on her soft and lovely body. Her blue eyes were set off by a bright framework of lavishly applied cosmetics. I took 4 ice trays out of the freezer and emptied them into an ice bucket. I told her I had been wondering who lived in that house.
"Officially, it's just Joe," she said. "But sometimes it's hard to tell, with so many people spending the night, or the week, or a few months. I live in Waycross, and I drive into Savannah 6 days a week to sing at the clubs here in town. If I'm too tired to drive home at night, I just stay at Joe's."
Mandy said she had gone to the University of Tennessee on a half scholarship for twirling. She also said she had been crowned Miss BBW in Las Vegas a year before.
"Miss BBW?" "That stands for Miss Big Beautiful Woman," she said. "It's a beauty contest for large women. They put out a magazine and a line of clothing, the whole 9 yards. I didn't really plan on entering the pageant, though. My friend sent in the application."
I gave her the ice bucket.
"Hey," she said, "why don't you come on over and join us for a drink?"
I had been about to suggest that very thing myself, so I accepted without hesitation and followed her down the stairs and into the lane. Mandy walked gingerly. The pebbles clicked and skittered under her spike heels. "It's a long drive from Waycross to Savannah, isn't it?" I asked.
"About an hour and a half," she said, "each way."
"Doesn't that get a little boring day after day?"
"Not really. It gives me a chance to do my nails."
"Your nails?"
"Of course,"
she giggled.
"Why not?"
"I don't know, it just sounds a little complicated," I said, "doing your nails and driving at the same time."
"It's real easy once you get the hang of it," she said. "I drive with my knees."
"Your knees?"
"Uh-huh. Actually, I save my nails for last. I do my makeup first, and then my hair."
I looked at the brilliant palette of colors on Mandy's smiling face. This was no simple application of lipstick and mascara. It was a complex composition that involved the blending of many hues and tints. They were pinks and blues and umber, topped by the platinum blonde nimbus of her hair.
"I backcomb my hair," she said.
"You must attract a lot of attention on the road," I said, "doing all that."
"Yeah, sometimes," she said. "Yesterday I pulled into a gas station, and this truck driver followed right behind me and pulled up alongside. He said, 'Ma'am, I have been driving behind you for the last 45 minutes, and I've been watching. First you did your makeup, then you did your hair, then you did your nails. I just wanted to get up close and see what you looked like.' He gave me a big wink and told me I was right pretty. But then he said, 'Let me ask you something. I notice every couple of minutes you've been reaching over and fooling with something on the seat next to you. What you got over there?' 'That's my TV,' I told him. 'I can't miss my soaps.'
We walked from the lane into Joe Odom's garden. Candlelight flickered in the windows of the darkened house. Two men crouched by the garden wall. One held a flashlight, while the other knelt in front of the electric meter. The kneeling man wore big rubber gloves with which he gripped a large pair of pliers. He appeared to be splicing two cables together.
"Careful, Joe," the man with the flashlight said.
A shower of sparks jumped from the cable, and the lights in the house next door dimmed for a moment. As they came back up to full strength, the lights in Joe's house blinked on. Cheers came from inside. Joe stood up.
"Well, I guess I didn't get electrocuted this time," he said. "Maybe next time."
He bowed silently to the neighboring house. Joe Odom had a mustache and graying blonde hair. He wore a light blue shirt open at the neck, chinos, and blue and white saddle shoes. He was about 35 and looked remarkably calm, I thought, for someone who had just pulled off a life-threatening, high-voltage act of larceny.
"I've got ice," said Mandy.
"And an ice man, too, I see."
Joe flashed a bright smile.
"I don't usually putter around in the garden this late at night," he said. "But, well, we had a few problems out here that needed tending to."
He took off the rubber gloves.
"I reckon I'm getting pretty good at this. I can turn water and gas back on, too. Remember that. Someday you may need my services. I'm only fair at telephones, though. I can reconnect a phone that's been cut off, but I can't make it do anything but receive incoming calls. No outgoing."
Somewhere under the steps, an air conditioning condenser clicked on.
"Lovely sound, isn't it?" said Joe. "Why don't we all go inside and drink a toast to it? And to the lights. And the dishwasher. And the microwave. And the refrigerator. And the Savannah Electric and Power Company. And to..."
He raised an imaginary glass in the direction of the house next door.
"Whoever."
Joe Odom's townhouse was furnished in a manner I wouldn't have expected for the home of a utilities deadbeat. On the parlor floor, I saw a fine English sideboard, several good 18th-century oil portraits, a pair of antique silver sconces, a Steinway grand piano, and two or three impressive oriental carpets. There were people in every room, it seemed. Not quite a party, more an open house.
"I'm a tax lawyer," said Joe, "and a real estate broker, and a piano player. I used to be a partner in a law firm, but a couple of years ago I quit and moved my office into this house so I could mix business and pleasure in whatever proportion I wanted. That's when my third wife left me."
Joe nodded toward a young man asleep on a couch in the living room.
"That's Clint. If you ever need a ride to Atlanta, Clint'll be happy to take you. He drives trailer trucks back and forth, and he likes to have company in the cab. I should warn you, though, he makes the trip in just under 3 hours. Nobody who's ever been on one of those wild rides has ever gone back for a second one."
A girl with a red ponytail was talking on the telephone in the kitchen. Joe told me she was a disc jockey for one of Savannah's top 40 radio stations. He added that a man she was dating had just been arrested for dealing cocaine and for making terroristic threats against the police. In the dining room, a blonde man dressed in a white shirt and white slacks was cutting a woman's hair.
"That's Jerry Spence," said Joe. "He cuts all our hair, and right now he's doing Anne, my first and second wife. Anne and I were childhood sweethearts. We got married the first time while I was in law school, and the second time on the anniversary of our first divorce. And, of course, you've met Mandy here. She's my fourth wife in waiting."
"What's she waiting for?" I asked.
"For her divorce to come through," said Joe. "There's no telling when that will happen, because her attorney's a lazy cuss who hadn't gotten around to filing the papers yet. I guess we can't complain about it, though, because I'm her attorney."
The social center of the house was the kitchen, which overlooked the garden. It had a piano in it, and it was from this room that the music and laughter spilled out over the garden walls up and down the street.
"I notice you leave your front door unlocked," I said.
"That's right. It got to be too much trouble going down to answer it all the time.
That was one of my third wife's grievances.
Odom laughed.
Well, the front door happens to be one of my grievances, too, said Mandy, especially since the burglary last week. Joe says it wasn't a burglary, but I say it was. It was 4 o'clock in the morning, we were both in bed. I woke up and heard noises downstairs, and I shook Joe. Joe, we got burglars, I said. But he didn't care. Oh, it could be anybody, he said. But I was sure it was burglars. They were opening cupboards and drawers and I don't know what all. So I shook him again and I said, Joe, go down and see. Well, Mr. Cool just lifted his head a few inches off the pillow and hollered, Angus? That you, Angus? There was total silence, of course. So Joe says to me, Well, if we got a burglar, his name ain't Angus. Then he went back to sleep. But it was a burglar, and we were lucky we weren't murdered. Joe started to play the piano in the middle of Mandy's story. In the morning, he said, 3 bottles of liquor and 6 glasses were missing. That doesn't sound like a burglary to me. It sounds like a party, and the only thing that annoys me about it is we weren't invited. Joe's smile indicated that the matter was closed, at least as far as he was concerned. Anyway, as I was saying, I originally left the door unlocked as a matter of convenience, but pretty soon I realized that whenever the doorbell did ring, it was someone I didn't know. So the bell became a signal that a stranger was at the door. I've learned never to answer it myself when that happens, because it's likely to be a deputy sheriff wanting to serve me with some kind of paper, and of course I don't need to be home for that. Or for little old ladies with hammers in their hands, I said. Hammers? I don't believe I know any old ladies who carry hammers. The one who punched out your windows certainly had a hammer.
A little old lady did that?
Joe looked surprised.
I was wondering how that happened. We thought somebody slammed the door too hard. You mean you saw her do it?
I did. Well, we've got our share of little old ladies here in Savannah, said Joe. And it looks like one of them's unhappy with me.
He didn't seem the least bit concerned.
Well, now you know something about us, he said. Tell us about yourself. I said I was a writer from New York.
Ah, then you must be the new Yankee I've been hearing about.
Nothing escapes our notice, you know. Savannah's a real small town. It's so small, everybody knows everybody else's business, which can be a pain, but it also means we know who all the undercover cops are, which can be a plus. Now, as for you, I should tell you that you've already aroused a fair amount of curiosity. People think you're writing an expose about Savannah, so they're a little wary of you. You don't need to fret about that, though. Secretly, they all hope you'll put them in your book.
Joe laughed and winked.
Savannah's a peculiar place, but if you just listen to your cousin Joe, you'll get along fine. You need to know about a few basic rules, though. Rule number one, always stick around for one more drink. That's when things happen. That's when you find out everything you want to know.
I think I can live with that one, I said.
Rule number two, never go south of Gaston Street. A true Savannian is a Nog. Nog means north of Gaston. We stay in the old part of town. We don't do the mall. We don't do the south side unless we're invited to a party for rich people out at the landings. Everything south of Gaston Street is North Jacksonville to us, and ordinarily we leave it alone. Rule number three. Observe the high holidays. St. Patrick's Day and the day of the Georgia-Florida football game. Savannah has the third biggest St. Patrick's Day parade in America. People come from all over the south to see it. Businesses close for the day, except for restaurants and bars, and the drinking starts at about 6 a.m. Liquor is a major feature of the Georgia-Florida game, too, but the similarity ends there. The game is nothing less than a war between the gentlemen of Georgia and the Florida barbarians. We get all keyed up for it a week ahead of time, and then afterwards, it takes a week to 10 days to deal with the emotional strain of having won, or lost. Georgia men grow up understanding the seriousness of that one game.
Georgia women grow up understanding it, too,
said Mandy. Ask any girl in South Georgia. She'll tell you flat out, you don't start wearing pantyhose until after the Georgia-Florida game.
I felt myself becoming a fast friend of Joe and Mandy. So look here, Joe said, now that you've come under our protective custody, we'll be unhappy with you if you need anything and don't ask for it, or if you get into trouble and don't holler. Mandy climbed into Joe's lap and nuzzled his ear.
Just make sure you put us in your book, he said. You understand, of course, that we'll want to play ourselves in the movie version, won't we, Mandy?
Mm-hmm, she said.
Joe played a few bars of Hooray for Hollywood, another Johnny Mercer tune.
In that book of yours, he said, you can use my real name if you want to. Or you can just call me the sentimental gentleman from Georgia, because that's pretty much who I am.
Joe sang Sentimental Gentleman with such winsome charm, I had to remind myself that he was the same person who had tapped into the electricity of the house next door, and who was, by his own admission, dodging process servers for financial transgressions of God knew what proportion. His ingratiating manner made everything he did seem like good-natured fun. Later, as he saw me to the door, he joked and bantered with such easy grace that I didn't fully realize until I got home that in the course of saying goodbye, he had borrowed $20 from me. Chapter 4 Settling In. Having made what I took to be a promising, if unorthodox, start on a social life, I set about arranging my apartment, so I could live and work in it comfortably. For essential things like bookshelves, file cabinets, and reading lamps, I visited a junk shop on the edge of town. It was a cluttered, barn-like warehouse that extended back into a series of rooms filled with Formica dinette sets, sofas, office furniture, and all manner of machinery from washer-dryers to apple corers. The owner sat like a Buddha behind a desk, barking hellos to customers and instructions to his salesman. The salesman was an expressionless man in his mid-30s. He had mousy brown hair parted at the center, and his arms hung loosely at his sides. His clothes were clean but faded, like the suits and shirts on a rack in one corner of the store. I was immediately impressed by the man's instant recall of the store's vast inventory. "We have 7 of that type item," he would say. "One's like new, 4 work pretty good, 1's broke but could be fixed, and the other's on layaway." In addition to having a mental catalog of the place, the salesman was a virtuoso on the strengths and weaknesses of practically any brand of appliance, particularly brands no longer in existence. "Kelvinator made a good one in the early 50s," he'd say. "It had 5 speeds, it was real easy to clean, and you could get replacement parts right quick." Impressed as I was by all of that, I was struck even more by something else. A carefully applied arc of purple eyeshadow that blazed like a lurid sunset on his left eyelid. At first, I found it difficult to listen to what he was saying, distracted as I was by the eyeshadow. I wondered what nocturnal transformation was built around this painted eye. I envisioned a tiara and a strapless gown, a fluttering ostrich fan at the end of a long white glove. Or was this something quite different? Was it, perhaps, the war paint of punk? Did this mild-mannered man spend his secret hours in jackboots, ripped T-shirts, and spiked hair? Eventually, my attention wandered back to what the man was saying, and I bought what it was he was showing me. The next week, I dropped in at the shop again, and this time I tried very hard not to stare at the purple eyeshadow on the man's left eye. From time to time, while he was waiting on me, the boss would shout questions from his desk about whether such and such an item was in stock. The salesman would cock an ear and call out the answer over his shoulder, without looking directly at his boss. After one such exchange, the salesman said in a low voice, "What the boss don't know won't hurt him."
"What do you mean?" I said.
"He didn't like this," the salesman said, pointing to his left eye.
"I don't do drag or anything sick like that. I just do my eyes. I used to do my other eye the same way, too. The boss told me to stop, and I was all set to walk out the door and never come back. But then I figured,
Wait a minute. He never gets out of that chair, see, and my desk is over by his left side. If I only do the eye away from him, maybe he'll never notice.
That was 2 years ago, and he ain't said nothing about it since. On my next visit to the shop, the salesman was out to lunch, but due back soon. The boss and I chatted. "Jack's a good man," he said, speaking of his salesman. "Best I've ever seen. He's a strange one, though. He's a loner. This shop and everything in it is his whole life. I call him Jack the One-Eyed Jill. Not to his face, of course. He used to put that eye makeup on both eyes, you know. God, it looked awful. I told him, I can't have this in my shop, no more or you're out. So what'd he do? Came in the next day not wearing any eye makeup at all, as far as I could tell. But he was walking sideways around the store like a damn crab, twisting this way and that. Then he went past a mirrored wardrobe, and I saw it plain as day. He'd put the makeup on the other eye. I was ready to kick his butt clear out the door then and there. But he's good at what he does, and it doesn't seem to bother the customers. So I kept my mouth shut. And from that day to this, he's kept that eye turned away from me. He must take me for blind or some kind of idiot, but that's okay with me. He pretends he's not wearing makeup, and I pretend I don't know he's ignored my wishes. Meanwhile, he keeps walking sideways, twisting around, speaking out of the corner of his mouth, and hoping I won't notice. And I make out like I don't. I don't know who's crazier, Jack the One-Eyed Jill or me. But we get along just fine. Before long, I found myself settling into a pattern of daily routines. An early morning jog around Forsyth Park, breakfast at Clary's drugstore, a late afternoon walk along Bull Street. I discovered that my activities coincided with the daily rituals of certain other people. No matter how widely our paths may have diverged for the rest of the day, we overlapped again and again at our appointed hour and place. The black man who jogged around Forsyth Park at the same hour I did was one such person. He was lean, very dark, and a little over 6 feet tall. When I fell in behind him the first time, I noticed he was carrying a short blue leather strap. Most of it was wound around his hand. 8 or 10 inches of it protruded. He snapped the free end against his thigh every other step, producing a rhythmic whap that forced me to run in step or very much out of step. I ran in step. It was easier. As he turned the corner at the south end of the park that first day, he looked back in my direction, but not quite at me, a little behind me. I looked over my shoulder. About 50 yards back, there was a blonde woman jogging with a little terrier romping beside her. The next time I started my run, the blonde woman and her dog were running ahead of me. The dog would dart into the park and then double back to join her. As I drew near, she turned her head to look across the park toward Drayton Street on the other side. The black man was jogging along Drayton, having already made both turns at the far end. He looked back at her. After this, I never saw one of them without also seeing the other. He always carried the little blue leather strap. She always had her dog with her. Sometimes he was in the lead, sometimes she was. They were always separated by at least 100 yards. One day, I saw the man at the M&M supermarket pushing a shopping cart. Another time, I caught sight of him getting into a late-model green Lincoln on Wright Square. But no blue strap, and no blonde woman. A few days later, I saw the blonde woman coming out of a bank. She was unaccompanied except for her terrier, who trotted along beside her. He was straining at the end of a blue leather leash. "We don't do black on white in Savannah," Joe Odom told me when I mentioned having seen this couple. "Especially black male on white female. A lot may have changed here in the last 20 years, but not that. Badness is the only woman I know of who had a black lover and got away with it. Badness was the wife of an influential Savannah businessman, and she had lovers during most of their marriage. That was all perfectly acceptable. Savannah will put up with public infidelity no matter how flagrant it is. Savannah loves it, can't get enough of it. But even Badness knew enough to leave Savannah and go to Atlanta when she felt the urge to have an affair with a black man." I understood all that, but I still wondered about certain small details concerning my jogging companions. Why, for instance, did he carry the leash?
And when and where did they get close enough for her to give it to him? The whole point, I finally realized, was that I would never know.